Chapter 10 Beneath the Demon Moon 2 1 Carl's grip on Susan's arm was firm but not painful. There was nothing particularly cruel about the way she was moving Susan along the downstairs corridor, but there was a relentlessness about it that was disheartening. Susan didn't try to protest. It would have been useless. Behind the two women were a pair of vaqueros, armed with knives and bolas rather than guns. The available guns had all gone west with Jonas. Behind the vac, skulking along like a sullen ghost which lacks the necessary psychic energy to fully materialize itself, came the late Chancellor's older brother, Laszlo. Reynolds, his taste for a spot of Journey's End rape blunted by his growing sense of disquiet, had either remained above or gone off to town.
"I'm going to put you in the cold pantry until I know better what to do with you, dear," Carl said. "You'll be quite safe there, and warm. How fortunate you were, Serape. Then, when Jonas gets back, he'll never see Cy Jonas again," Susan said. "He won't ever." Fresh pain exploded in her sensitive face. For a moment it seemed the entire world had blown up. Susan reeled back against the dressed stone wall of the lower corridor, her vision first blurred, then slowly clearing. She could feel blood flowing down her cheek from a wound opened by the stone in Coral's ring when Coral had backhanded her, and her nose. That cussed thing was bleeding again, too. Coral was looking at her in a chilly, this-is-all-business-to-me fashion, but Susan believed she saw something different in the woman's eyes. Fear, mayhap.
"Don't talk to me about Eldred, missy. He's sent to catch the boys who killed my brother, the boys you set loose."
"Get off it." Susan wiped her nose, grimaced at the blood pooled in her palm, and wiped it on the leg of her pants.
"I know who killed Hart as well as you do yourself, so don't pull mine and I won't yank your own."
She watched Coral's hand rise, ready to slap, and managed a dry laugh.
"Go on, cut my face open on the other side if you like. Will that change how you sleep tonight, with no man to warm the other side of the bed?"
Coral's hand came down fast and hard, but instead of slapping, it seized Susan's arm again. Hard enough to hurt this time, but Susan barely felt it. She had been hurt by experts this day, and would suffer more hurt gladly if that would hasten the moment when she and Roland could be together again. Coral hauled her the rest of the way down the corridor, through the kitchen. That great room, which would have been all steam and bustle on any other reaping day, now stood uncannily deserted, and to the iron-bound door on the far side. This she opened. A smell of potatoes and gourds and sharproot drifted out.
"Get in there! Go smart before I decide to kick your winsome ass square!"
Susan looked her in the eye, smiling.
"I damn ye for a murderer's bed, bitch, Si Thorin, but ye've already damned yourself. You know it, too, 'tis written in your face, to be sure, so I'll just drop ye a curtsy."
Still smiling, she suited action to the words,
"And wish ye a very good day." "Get in and shut up your saucy mouth!"
Coral cried, and pushed Susan into the cold pantry. She slammed the door, ran the bolt, and turned her blazing eyes upon the vax, who stood prudently away from her.
"Keep her well, muchachos. Mind ye do."
She brushed between them, not listening to their assurances, and went up to her late brother's suite to wait for Jonas. Or word of Jonas. The whey-faced bitch sitting down there amongst the carrots and potatoes knew nothing. But her words, "You'll never see Cy Jonas again," were in Coral's head now. They echoed and would not leave. 12 of the clock sounded from the squat bell tower atop the town gathering hall. And if the unaccustomed silence which hung over the rest of Hambry seemed strange as that reap morning passed into afternoon, the silence in the Traveler's Rest was downright eerie. Better than 200 souls were packed together beneath the dead gaze of the romp, all of them drinking hard. Yet there was hardly a sound among them, save for the shuffle of feet and the impatient rap of glasses on the bar, indicating that another drink was wanted. Sheb had tried a hesitant tune on the piano, Big Bottle Boogie, everyone liked that one, and a cowboy with a mutie mark on one cheek had put the tip of a knife in his ear and told him to shut up that noise if he wanted to keep what passed for his brains on the starboard side of his eardrum. Sheb, who would be happy to go on drawing breath for another 1,000 years if the gods so allowed, quit his piano bench at once and went to the bar to help Stanley and Petty the Trotter serve up the booze. The mood of the drinkers was confused and sullen. Reaping Fair had been stolen from them, and they didn't know what to do about it. There would still be a bonfire and plenty of stuffy guys to burn on it, but there were no reap kisses today, and would be no dancing tonight. No riddles, no races, no pig wrestle, no jokes, no good cheer, damn it! No hearty farewell to the end of the year! Instead of joviality, there had been murder in the dark and the escape of the guilty, and now only the hope of retribution instead of the certainty of it. These folk, sullen, drunk, and as potentially dangerous as storm clouds filled with lightning, wanted someone to focus on, someone to tell them what to do. And, of course, someone to toss on the fire, as in the days of Eld. It was at this point, not long after the last toll of noon had faded into the cold air, that the batwing doors opened and 2 women came in. A good many knew the crone in the lead, and several of them crossed their eyes with their thumbs as a ward against her evil look. A murmur ran through the room. It was the Coos, the old witch woman, and although her face was pocked with sores and her eyes sunk so deep in their sockets they could barely be seen, she gave off a peculiar sense of vitality. Her lips were red, as if she had been eating winter berries. The woman behind her walked slowly and stiffly, with one hand pressed against her midsection. Her face was as white as the witch woman's mouth was red. Rhea advanced to the middle of the floor, passing the gawking trail hands at the watch-me tables without so much as a glance. When she reached the center of the bar and stood directly beneath the romp's glare, she turned to look at the silent drovers and townsfolk.
"Most of ye know me," she cried, in a rusty voice which stopped just short of stridency. "Those of ye who don't have never wanted a love potion, or needed the ram put back in your rod, or gotten tired of a naggin' mother-in-law's tongue. I'm Rhea, the wise woman of the Coos, and this lady beside me is aunt to the girl who freed 3 murderers last night, this same girl who murdered your town sheriff, and a good young man, married he was, and with a kid on the way. He stood before her with his defenseless hands raised, pleading for his life on behalf of his wife and his babby to come, and still she shot him. Cruel she is, cruel and heartless."
A mutter ran through the crowd. Rhea raised her twisted old claws, and it stilled at once. She turned in a slow circle to see them all, hands still raised, looking like the world's oldest, ugliest prize fighter.
"Strangers came, and ye welcomed them in," she cried in her rusty crow's voice. "Welcomed them and gave them bread to eat, and it's ruin they fed ye in return. The deaths of those ye loved and depended on, spoilage in the time of the harvest, and gods know what curses upon the time to follow, Findanio."
More murmurs, now louder. She had touched their deepest fear, that this year's evil would spread, might even snarl the newly threaded stock which had so slowly and hopefully begun to emerge along the outer arc.
"But they've gone, and likely won't be back," Rhea continued. "Mayhap just as well. Why should their strange blood taint our ground? But there's this other, one raised among us, a young woman gone traitor to her town and rogue among her own kind."
Her voice dropped to a hoarse whisper on this last phrase. Her listeners strained forward to hear, faces grim, eyes big. And now Rhea pulled the pallid, skinny woman in the rusty black dress forward. She stood Cordelia in front of her like a doll or a ventriloquist dummy and whispered in her ear. But the whisper traveled somehow. They all heard it.
"Come, dear, tell him what ye told me."
In a dead, carrying voice, Cordelia said,
"She said she wouldn't be the mayor's Jilly."
He wasn't good enough for such as her, she said. And then she seduced Will Dearborn. The price of her body was a fine position in Gilead as his consort, and the murder of Hart Thorin. Dearborn paid her price. Lusty as he was for her, he paid gladly. His friends helped. They may have had the use of her as well, for all I know. Chancellor Rymer must have gotten in their way, or perhaps they just saw him and felt like doing him too.
Bastards! Patty cried. Sneaking young culls! Now tell 'em what's needed to clarify the new season before it's spiled, dearie, Rhea said in a crooning voice.
Cordelia Delgado raised her head and looked around at the men. She took a breath, pulling the sour, intermingled smells of graff and beer and smoke and whiskey deep into her spinster's lungs.
Take her. He must take her. I say it in love and sorrow, so I do.
Silent, their eyes.
Paint her hands.
The glass gaze of the thing on the wall, looking its stuffed judgment over the waiting room.
Char you tree, Cordelia whispered.
They did not cry their agreement, but sighed it, like autumn wind through stripped trees. Three. Shimi ran after the bad coffin hunter and Susan Sai until he could literally run no more. His lungs were afire, and the stitch which had formed in his side turned into a cramp. He pitched forward onto the grass of the drop, his left hand clutching his right armpit, grimacing with pain. He lay there for some time, with his face deep in the fragrant grass, knowing they were getting farther and farther ahead, but also knowing it would do him no good to get up and start running again until the stitch was good and gone. If he tried to hurry the process, the stitch would simply come back and lay him low again. So he lay where he was, lifting his head to look at the tracks left by Susan Sai and the bad coffin hunter, and he was just about ready to try his feet when Capricoso bit him. Not a nip, mind you, but a good healthy chomp. Cappy had had a difficult 24 hours, and he hadn't much liked to see the author of all his misery lying on the grass apparently taking a nap.
"Yow, by damn!"
Shimi cried and rocketed to his feet. There was nothing so magical as a good bite on the ass, a man of more philosophic bent might have reflected. It made all other concerns, no matter how heavy or sorrowful, disappear like smoke. He whirled about.
"Why did you do that, you mean old sneak of a Cappy?"
Shimi was rubbing his bottom vigorously, and large tears of pain stood out in his eyes.
"That hurts like a big old son of a bitch!"
Capricoso extended his neck to its maximum length, bared his teeth in the satanic grin which only mules and dromedaries can command, and brayed. To Shimi, that bray sounded very like laughter. The mule's lead still trailed back between his sharp little hoofs. Shimi reached for it, and when Cappy dipped his head to inflict another bite, the boy gave him a good hard whack across the side of his narrow head. Cappy snorted and blinked.
"You had that coming, mean old Cappy," Shimi said. "I'll have to shit from a squat for a week, so I will. Won't be able to sit on the damn jakes."
He doubled the lead over his fist and climbed aboard the mule. Cappy made no attempt to buck him off, but Shimi winced as his wounded part settled atop the ridge of the mule's spine. This was good luck just the same, though, he thought, as he kicked the animal into motion. His ass hurt, but at least he wouldn't have to walk, or try to run with a stitch in his side.
"Go on, stupid," he said. "Hurry up, fast as you can, you old son of a bitch!"
In the course of the next hour, Shimi called Cappy "you old son of a bitch" as often as possible. He had discovered, as many others had before him, that only the first cuss word is really hard. After that, there's nothing quite like them for relieving one's feelings. 4. Susan's trail cut diagonally across the drop toward the coast and the grand old adobe that rose there. When Shimi reached seafront, he dismounted outside the arch and only stood, wondering what to do next. That they had come here, he had no doubt. Susan's horse, Pylon, and the bad coffin hunter's horse were tethered side by side in the shade, occasionally dropping their heads and blowing in the pink stone trough that ran along the courtyard's ocean side. What to do now? The riders who came and went beneath the arch, mostly white-headed Vax who'd been considered too old to form a part of Lengo's party, paid no attention to the inn-boy and his mule. But Miguel might be a different story. The old mozo had never liked him, acted as if he thought Shimi would turn thief, given half a chance, and if he saw Coral's slop and carry boy skulking in the courtyard, Miguel would very likely drive him away.
No, he won't, he thought grimly. Not today. Today I can't let him boss me. I won't go even if he hollers.
But if the old man did holler and raised an alarm, what then? The bad coffin hunter might come and kill him. Shimi had reached a point where he was willing to die for his friends, but not unless it served a purpose. So he stood in the cold sunlight, shifting from foot to foot, irresolute, wishing he was smarter than he was, that he could think of a plan. An hour passed this way, then two. It was slow time, each passing moment an exercise in frustration. He sensed any opportunity to help Susan Sai slipping away, but didn't know what to do about it. Once he heard what sounded like thunder from the west, although a bright fall day like this didn't seem right for thunder. He had about decided to chance the courtyard anyway. It was temporarily deserted, and he might be able to make it across to the main house. When the man he had feared came staggering out of the stables. Miguel Torres was festooned with reap charms and was very drunk. He approached the center of the courtyard in rolling side-to-side loops, the tug-string of his sombrero twisted against his scrawny throat, his long white hair flying. The front of his chibosa was wet, as if he had tried to take a leak without remembering that you had to unlimber your dingus first. He had a small ceramic jug in one hand. His eyes were fierce and bewildered.
"Who done this?" Miguel cried.
He looked up at the afternoon sky and the demon moon which floated there. Little Ashimi liked the old man. His heart cringed. It was bad luck to look directly at old demon, so it was.
"Who done this thing? I ask that you tell me, senor, por favor."
A pause, then a scream so powerful that Miguel reeled on his feet and almost fell. He raised his fists as if he would box an answer out of the winking face in the moon, then dropped them wearily. Corn liquor slopped from the neck of the jug and wet him further.
"Maricón," he muttered.
He staggered to the wall, almost tripping over the rear legs of the bad coffin hunter's horse as he went, then sat down with his back against the adobe wall. He drank deeply from the jug, then pulled his sombrero up and settled it over his eyes. His arm twitched the jug, then settled it back, as if in the end it had proved too heavy. Shimi waited until the old man's thumb came unhooked from the jug handle and the hand flopped onto the cobbles. He started forward, then decided to wait even a little longer. Miguel was old, and Miguel was mean, but Shimi guessed Miguel might also be tricky. Lots of folks were, especially the mean ones. He waited until he heard Miguel's dusty snores, then led Cappy into the courtyard, wincing at every clop of the mule's hooves. Miguel never stirred, however. Shimi tied Cappy to the end of the hitching rail, wincing again as Capricoso brayed a tuneless greeting to the horses tied there, then walked quickly across to the main door through which he had never in his life expected to pass. He put his hand on the great iron latch, looked back once more at the old man sleeping against the wall, then opened the door and tiptoed in. He stood for a moment in the oblong of sun, the open door admitted, his shoulders hunched all the way up to his ears, expecting a hand to settle on the scruff of his neck, which bad-natured folk always seemed able to find, no matter how high you hunched your shoulders, at any moment, an angry voice would follow, asking what he thought he was doing here. The foyer stood empty and silent. On the far wall was a tapestry depicting vaqueros herding horses along the drop. Against it leaned a guitar with a broken string. Shimi's feet sent back echoes no matter how lightly he walked. He shivered. This was a house of murder now, a bad place. There were likely ghosts. Still, Susan was here, somewhere. He passed through the double doors on the far side of the foyer and entered the reception hall. Beneath its high ceiling, his footfalls echoed more loudly than ever. Long dead mayors looked down at him from the walls. Most had spooky eyes that seemed to follow him as he walked, marking him as an intruder. He knew their eyes were only paint, but still. One in particular troubled him, a fat man with clouds of red hair, a bulldog mouth, and a mean glare in his eye, as if he wanted to ask what some half-wit inn-boy was doing in the great hall at Mayor's house.
"Quit looking at me that way, you big old son of a bitch!"
Shimi whispered and felt a little better, for the moment at least. Next came the dining hall, also empty, with the long trestle tables pushed back against the wall. There was the remains of a meal on one, a single plate of cold chicken and sliced bread, half a mug of ale. Looking at those few bits of food on a table that had served dozens at various fairs and festivals, that should have served dozens this very day, brought the enormity of what had happened home to Shimi. And the sadness of it, too. Things had changed in Hambry, and would likely never be the same again. These long thoughts did not keep him from gobbling the leftover chicken and bread, or from chasing it with what remained in the ale pot. It had been a long, foodless day. He belched, clapped both hands over his mouth, eyes making quick and guilty side-to-side darts above his dirty fingers, and then walked on. The door at the far end of the room was latched, but unlocked. Shimi opened it and poked his head out into the corridor which ran the length of Mayor's house. The way was lit with gas chandeliers and was as broad as an avenue. It was empty, at least for the moment, but he could hear whispering voices from other rooms, and perhaps other floors as well. He supposed they belonged to the maids and any other servants that might be about this afternoon, but they sounded very ghostly to him just the same. Perhaps one belonged to Mayor Thorin, wandering the corridor right in front of him, if Shimi could but see him, which he was glad he couldn't. Mayor Thorin wandering and wondering what had happened to him, what this cold, jelly-like stuff soaking into his nightshirt might be. Who? A hand gripped Shimi's arm just above the elbow. He almost shrieked.
"Don't!" a woman whispered. "For your father's sake!"
Shimi somehow managed to keep the scream in. He turned, and there, wearing jeans and a plain checked ranch shirt, her hair tied back, her pale face set, her dark eyes blazing, stood the mayor's widow.
"Thorin, I...
There was nothing else he could think of to say. Now she'll call for the guards of the watch if there be any left, he thought. In a way it would be a relief.
"Have you come for the girl? The Delgado girl?"
Grief had been good to Olive in a terrible way, had made her face seem less plump and oddly young. Her dark eyes never left his and forbade any attempt at a lie. Shimi nodded.
"Good. I can use your help, boy. She's down below in the pantry and she's guarded."
Shimi gaped, not believing what he was hearing.
"Do you think I believe she had anything to do with Hart's murder?"
Olive asked, as if Shimi had objected to her idea.
"I may be fat and not so speedy on my pins anymore, but I'm not a complete idiot. Come on now, Seafront's not a good place for Cy Delgado just now. Too many people from town know where she is."
5. Roland. He will hear this voice in uneasy dreams for the rest of his life, never quite remembering what he has dreamed, only knowing that the dreams leave him feeling ill somehow, walking restlessly, straightening pictures in loveless rooms, listening to the call to muezzin in alien town squares. Roland of Gilead. This voice, which he almost recognizes, a voice so like his own that a psychiatrist from Eddie's or Susanna's or Jake's when and where would say it is his voice, the voice of his subconscious. But Roland knows better. Roland knows that often the voices that sound the most like our own when they speak in our heads are those of the most terrible outsiders, the most dangerous intruders. Roland, son of Stephen. The ball has taken him first to Hanbury and to Mayor's house, and he would see more of what is happening there, but then it takes him away, calls him away, in that strangely familiar voice, and he has to go. There is no choice, because unlike Rhea or Jonas, he is not watching the ball and the creatures who speak soundlessly within it. He is inside the ball, a part of its endless pink storm. Roland, come. Roland, see. And so the storm whirls him first up and then away. He flies across the drop, rising and rising through stacks of air, first warm and then cold, and he is not alone in the pink storm, which bears him west along the path of the beam. Sheb flies past him, his hat cocked back on his head. He is singing Hey Jude at the top of his lungs, as his nicotine-stained fingers plink keys that are not there. Transported by his tune, Sheb doesn't seem to realize that the storm has ripped his piano away. Roland, come, the voice says, the voice of the storm, the voice of the glass, and Roland comes. The romp flies by him, glassy eyes blazing with pink light. A scrawny man in farmer's overalls goes flying past, his long red hair streaming out behind him. Life for you and for your crop, he says, something like that anyway, and then he's gone. Next, spinning like a weird windmill, comes an iron chair. To Roland, it looks like a torture device equipped with wheels, and the boy gunslinger thinks the Lady of Shadows, without knowing why he thinks it or what it means. Now the pink storm is carrying him over blasted mountains, now over a fertile green delta, where a broad river runs its oxbow squiggles like a vein, reflecting a placid blue sky that turns to the pink of wild roses as the storm passes above. Ahead, Roland sees an uprushing column of darkness, and his heart quails, but this is where the pink storm is taking him, and this is where he must go. I want to get out, he thinks. But he's not stupid. He realizes the truth. He may never get out. The wizard's glass has swallowed him. He may remain in its stormy, muddled eye forever. I'll shoot my way out if I have to, he thinks, but no, he has no guns. He is naked in the storm, rushing bare-ass toward that virulent blue-black infection that has buried all the landscape beneath it. And yet he hears singing, faint but beautiful. A sweet, harmonic sound that makes him shiver and think of Susan, bird and bear and hare and fish. Suddenly, Shimi's mule, Capricoso, Roland thinks, a beautiful name, goes past, galloping on thin air, with his eyes as bright as fire dims in the storm's lumbre fuego. Following him, wearing a sombrero and riding a broom festooned with fluttering reap charms, comes Rhea of the Coos.
I'll get you, my pretty, she screams at the fleeing mule, and then, cackling, she is gone, zooming and brooming.
Roland plunges into the black, and suddenly his breath is gone. The world around him is noxious darkness. The air seems to creep on his skin like a layer of bugs. He is buffeted, boxed to and fro by invisible fists, then driven downward in a dive so violent he fears he will be smashed against the ground. So fell Lord Perth. Dead fields and deserted villages roll up out of the gloom. He sees blasted trees that will give no shade. Oh, but all is shade here. All is death here. This is the edge of Endworld, where some dark day he will come, and all is death here. Gunslinger, this is Thunderclap. Thunderclap, he says. Here are the unbreathing, the white faces. The unbreathing, the white faces. Yes, He knows that somehow. This is the place of slaughtered soldiers, the cloven helm, the rusty halberd. From here come the pale warriors. This is Thunderclap, where clocks run backward and the graveyards vomit out their dead. Ahead is a tree, like a crooked, clutching hand. On its topmost branch, a billy bumbler has been impaled. It should be dead, but as the pink storm carries Roland past, it raises its head and looks at him with inexpressible pain and weariness.
"Why?" it cries,
and then it too is gone, and not to be remembered for many years. Look ahead, Roland. See your destiny. Now suddenly he knows that voice. It is the voice of the turtle. He looks and sees a brilliant blue-gold glow piercing the dirty darkness of Thunderclap. Before he can do more than register it, he breaks out of the darkness and into the light like something coming out of an egg, a creature at last being born. "Light! Let there be light!" the voice of the turtle cries, and Roland has to put his hands to his eyes and peek through his fingers to keep from being blinded. Below him is a field of blood. Or so he thinks then, a boy of 14 who has that day done his first real killing. This is the blood that has flowed out of Thunderclap and threatens to drown our side of the world, he thinks. And it will not be for untold years that he will finally rediscover his time inside the ball and put this memory together with Eddie's dream and tell his compadres as they sit in the turnpike breakdown lane at the end of the night that he was wrong, that he had been fooled by the brilliance coming as it did so hard on the heels of Thunderclap shadows. It wasn't blood but roses, he tells Eddie, Susanna, and Jake.
Gunslinger, look. Look there.
Yes, there it is, a dusty gray-black pillar rearing on the horizon. The Dark Tower, the place where all beams, all lines of force converge. In its spiraling windows he sees fitful electric blue fire and hears the cries of all those pent within. He senses both the strength of the place and the wrongness of it. He can feel how it is spooling error across everything, softening the divisions between the worlds, how its potential for mischief is growing stronger, even as disease weakens its truth and coherence, like a body afflicted with cancer. This jutting arm of dark gray stone is the world's great mystery and last awful riddle. It is the tower, the Dark Tower, rearing to the sky. And as Roland rushes toward it in the pink storm, he thinks, "I will enter you, me and my friends, if Ka wills it so. We will enter you, and we will conquer the wrongness within you. It may be years yet, but I swear by bird and bear and hare and fish, by all I love that..." But now the sky fills with flaggy clouds, which flow out of Thunderclap, and the world begins to go dark. The blue light from the tower's rising windows shines like mad eyes, and Roland hears thousands of screaming, wailing voices. "You will kill everything and everyone you love," says the voice of the turtle. And now it is a cruel voice, cruel and hard. "And still the tower will be pent shut against you." The gunslinger draws in all his breath and draws together all his force. When he cries his answer to the turtle, he does so for all the generations of his blood. "No, it will not stand. When I come here in my body, it will not stand. I swear on my father's name, it will not stand."
"Then die," the voice says, and Roland is hurled at the gray-black stone flank of the tower to be smashed there like a bug against a rock. But before that can happen...
6. Cuthbert and Alain stood watching Roland with increasing concern. He had the piece of Merlin's rainbow raised to his face, cupped in his hands as a man might cup a ceremonial goblet before making a toast. The drawstring bag lay crumpled on the dusty toes of his boots. His cheeks and forehead were washed in a pink glow that neither boy liked. It seemed alive somehow, and hungry. They thought as if with one mind, I can't see his eyes. Where are his eyes?
Roland, Cuthbert repeated, if we're going to get out to Hanging Rock before they're ready for us, you have to put that thing away.
Roland made no move to lower the ball. He muttered something under his breath. Later, when Cuthbert and Alain had a chance to compare notes, they both agreed it had been thunderclap.
Roland? Alain asked, stepping forward.
As gingerly as a surgeon slipping a scalpel into the body of a patient, he slipped his right hand between the curve of the ball and Roland's bent, studious face. There was no response.
Alain pulled back and turned to Cuthbert.
Can you touch him? Bert asked.
Alain shook his head.
Not at all. It's like he's gone somewhere far away.
We have to wake him up.
Cuthbert's voice was dust dry and shaky at the edges.
Vanet told us that if you wake a person from a deep hypnotic trance too suddenly, he can go mad, Alain said.
Remember? I don't know if I dare, Roland stirred. The pink sockets where his eyes had been seemed to grow. His mouth flattened into the line of bitter determination they both knew well.
No, it will not stand, he cried, in a voice that made goose flesh ripple the skin of the other two boys.
That was not Roland's voice at all, at least not as he was now. That was the voice of a man.
No, Alain said much later, when Roland slept and he and Cuthbert sat up before the campfire. That was the voice of a king.
Now, however, the two of them only looked at their absent, roaring friend, paralyzed with fright.
When I come here in my body, it will not stand. I swear on my father's name, it will not stand.
Then, as Roland's unnaturally pink face contorted, like the face of a man who confronts some unimaginable horror, Cuthbert and Alain lunged forward. It was no longer a question of perhaps destroying him in an effort to save him. If they didn't do something, the glass would kill him as they watched. In the dooryard of the barquet, it had been Cuthbert who clipped Roland. This time Alain did the honors, administering a hard right to the center of the gunslinger's forehead. Roland tumbled backward, the ball spilling out of his loosening hands and the terrible pink light leaving his face. Cuthbert caught the boy, and Alain caught the ball. Its heavy pink glow was weirdly insistent, beating at his eyes and pulling at his mind. But Alain stuffed it resolutely into the drawstring bag again without looking at it, and as he pulled the cord, yanking the bag's mouth shut, he saw the pink light wink out, as if it knew it had lost, for the time being at least. He turned back and winced at the sight of the bruise puffing up from the middle of Roland's brow.
Is he out cold? Cuthbert said.
You better come too soon. Cuthbert looked at him grimly, with not a trace of his usual amiability.
Yes, he said. You're certainly right about that.
Seven. Shimi waited at the foot of the stairs which led down to the kitchen area, shifting uneasily from foot to foot and waiting for Cy Thorin to come back or to call him. He didn't know how long she'd been in the kitchen, but it felt like forever. He wanted her to come back. And more than that, more than anything, he wanted her to bring Susan Cy with her. Shimi had a terrible feeling about this place and this day, a feeling that darkened like the sky, which was now all obscured with smoke in the west. What was happening out there, or if it had anything to do with the thundery sounds he'd heard earlier, Shimi didn't know. But he wanted to be out of here before the smoke-hazed sun went down and the real demon moon, not its pallid day-ghost, rose in the sky. One of the swinging doors between the corridor and the kitchen pushed open, and Olive came hurrying out. She was alone.
"She's in the pantry, all right," Olive said.
She raked her fingers through her graying hair.
I got that much out of those two pupuras, but no more. I knew it was going to be that way as soon as they started talking that stupid crunk of theirs.
There was no proper word for the dialect of the Magus Vaqueros, but crunk served well enough among the barony's higher-born citizens. Olive knew both of the vacs guarding the pantry, in the vague way of a person who has once ridden a lot and passed gossip and weather with other drop riders, and she knew damned well these old boys could do better than Crunk. They had spoken it so they could pretend to misunderstand her, and save both them and her the embarrassment of an outright refusal. She had gone along with the deception for much the same reason, although she could have responded with Crunk of her own perfectly well, and called them some names their mothers never used had she wanted. "I told them there were men upstairs," she said, "and I thought maybe they meant to steal the silver. I said I wanted the maleficios turned out, and still they played dumb. No habla, si. Shit. Shit." Shimi thought of calling them a couple of big old son-of-a-bitches and decided to keep silent. She was pacing back and forth in front of him and throwing an occasional burning look at the closed kitchen doors. At last she stopped in front of Shimi again. "Turn out your pockets," she said. "Let's see what you have for hopes and garlands." Shimi did as she asked, producing a little pocket knife, a gift from Stanley Ruiz, and a half-eaten cookie from one. From the other he brought out 3 ladyfinger firecrackers, a big banger, and a few sulfur matches. Olive's eyes gleamed when she saw these. "Listen to me, Shimi," she said. 8. Cuthbert patted Roland's face with no result. Alain pushed him aside, knelt, and took the gunslinger's hands. He had never used the touch this way, but had been told it was possible, that one could reach another's mind, at least in some cases. "Roland! Roland, wake up! Please! We need you!" At first there was nothing. Then Roland stirred, muttered, and pulled his hands out of a lens. In the moment before his eyes opened, both of the other 2 boys were struck by the same fear of what they might see. No eyes at all, only raving pink light. But they were Roland's eyes, all right, those cool blue shooter's eyes. He struggled to gain his feet and failed the first time. He held out his hands. Cuthbert took one, Alain the other. As they pulled him up, Bert saw a strange and frightening thing. There were threads of white in Roland's hair. There had been none that morning. He would have sworn to it. The morning had been a long time ago, however. "How long was I out?" Roland touched the bruise in the center of his forehead with the tips of his fingers and winced. "Not long," Alain said. 5 minutes, maybe. "Roland, I'm sorry I hit you, but I had to. It was... I thought it was killing you." "Mayhap 'twas. Is it safe?" Alain pointed wordlessly to the drawstring bag. "Good. It's best one of you carry it for now. I might be..." He searched for the right word, and when he found it, a small, wintry smile touched the corners of his mouth. "Tempted," he finished. "Let's ride for Hanging Rock. We've got work yet to finish." "Roland," Cuthbert began. Roland turned, one hand on the horn of his horse's saddle. Cuthbert licked his lips, and for a moment Alain didn't think he would be able to ask. "If you don't, I will," Alain thought. But Bert managed, bringing the words out in a rush. "What did you see?" "Much," Roland said. "I saw much. But most of it is already fading out of my mind, the way dreams do when you wake up. What I do remember, I'll tell you as we ride. You must know, because it changes everything. We're going back to Gilead, but not for long." "Where after that?" Alain asked, mounting. "West, in search of the Dark Tower. If we survive today, that is. Come on, let's take those tankers." 9. The 2 vacs were rolling smokes when there was a loud bang from upstairs. They both jumped and looked at each other, the tobacco from their works in progress sifting down to the floor in small brown flurries. A woman shrieked. The doors burst open. It was the mayor's widow again, this time accompanied by a maid. The vacs knew her well, Maria Tomas, the daughter of an old compadre from the piano ranch. "The thieving bastards have set the place on fire," Maria cried, speaking to them in Crunk. "Come and help!"
Maria, Sai, we have orders to guard. A puttina locked in the pantry?
Maria shouted, her eyes blazing.
Come, you stupid old donkey, before the whole place catches. Then you can explain to Signor Lengel why you stood here using your thumbs for fart corks while Seafront burned down around your ears. Go on, Olive snapped. Are you cowards?
There were several smaller bangs, as above them in the great parlor Shimi set off the ladyfingers. He used the same match to light the drapes. The two viejos exchanged a glance.
Andale,
said the older of the two, then looked back at Maria. He no longer bothered with the crunk.
Watch this door, he said.
Like a hawk,
she agreed. The two old men bustled out, one gripping the cords of his bolas, the other pulling a long knife from the scabbard on his belt. As soon as the women heard their footsteps on the stairs at the end of the hall, Olive nodded to Maria and they crossed the room. Maria threw the bolts. Olive pulled the door open. Susan came out at once, looking from one to the other, then smiling tentatively. Maria gasped at the sight of her mistress's swelled face and the blood crusted around her nose. Susan took Maria's hand before the maid could touch her face and squeezed her fingers gently.
Do you think Thorin would want me now? She asked,
and then seemed to realize who her other rescuer was.
Olive! Sai Thorin, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be cruel. But ye must believe that Roland, him ye know as Will Dearborn, would never—
I know it well, Olive said. And there's no time for this now. Come on.
She and Maria led Susan out of the kitchen, away from the stairs ascending to the main house, and toward the storage rooms at the far north end of the lower level. In the dry goods storage room, Olive told the two of them to wait. She was gone for perhaps 5 minutes, but to Susan and Maria it seemed an eternity. When she came back, Olive was wearing a wildly colored serape much too big for her. It might have been her husband's, but Susan thought it looked too big for the late mayor as well. Olive had tucked a piece of it into the side of her jeans to keep from stumbling over it. Slung over her arm, like blankets, she had two more, both smaller and lighter.
"Put these on," she said. "It's going to be cold."
Leaving the dry goods store, they went down a narrow servant's passageway toward the back courtyard. There, if they were fortunate, and if Miguel was still unconscious, Shimi would be waiting for them with mounts. Olive hoped with all her heart that they would be fortunate. She wanted Susan safely away from Hambry before the sun went down. And before the moon rose. 10. Susan's been taken prisoner, Roland told the others as they rode west toward Hanging Rock. That's the first thing I saw in the glass. He spoke with such an air of absence that Cuthbert almost reined up. This wasn't the ardent lover of the last few months. It was as if Roland had found a dream to ride through the pink air within the ball, and part of him rode it still. Or is it riding him? Cuthbert wondered.
What? Alain asked. Susan taken? How? By whom? Is she all right?
Taken by Jonas. He hurt her some, but not too badly. She'll heal. And she'll live. I'd turn around in a second if I thought her life was in any real danger. Ahead of them, appearing and disappearing in the dust like a mirage, was Hanging Rock. Cuthbert could see the sunlight pricking hazy sun stars on the tankers, and he could see men, a lot of them, a lot of horses as well. He patted the neck of his own mount, then glanced across to make sure Alain had Lengil's machine gun. He did. Cuthbert reached around to the small of his back, making sure of the slingshot. It was there. Also his deerskin ammunition bag, which now contained a number of the big bangers Shimi had stolen, as well as steel shot.
He's using every ounce of his will to keep from going back anyway, Cuthbert thought.
He found the realization comforting. Sometimes Roland scared him. There was something in him that went beyond steel, something like madness. If it was there, you were glad to have it on your side, but often you wished it wasn't there at all, on anybody's side.
Where is she? Alain asked.
Reynolds took her back to Seafront. She's locked in the pantry, or was locked there. I can't say which exactly, because... Roland paused, thinking. The ball sees far, but sometimes it sees more. Sometimes it sees a future that's already happening.
How can the future already be happening?
Alen asked. I don't know. And I don't think it was always that way. I think it's more to do with the world than Merlin's rainbow. Time is strange now. We know that, don't we? How things sometimes seem to slip. It's almost as if there's a thinny everywhere, breaking things down. But Susan's safe. I know that, and that's enough for me. Shimi is going to help her, or is helping her. Somehow Jonas missed Shimi, and he followed Susan all the way back. Good for Shimi, Alan said, and pumped his fist into the air. Hurrah! Then, what about us? Did you see us in this future? No. This part was all quick. I hardly snatched more than a glance before the ball took me away. Flew me away, it seemed. But I saw smoke on the horizon, I remember that. It could have been the smoke of burning tankers, or the brush piled in front of Eyebolt, or both. I think we're going to succeed. Cuthbert was looking at his old friend in a queerly distraught way. The young man, so deeply in love that Bert had needed to knock him into the dust of the courtyard in order to wake him up to his responsibilities. Where was that young man, exactly? What had changed him, given him those disturbing strands of white hair? If we survive what's ahead, Cuthbert said, watching the gunslinger closely, she'll meet us on the road. Won't she, Roland? He saw the pain on Roland's face and now understood. The lover was here, but the ball had taken away his joy and left only grief. That, and some new purpose. Yes, Cuthbert felt it very well, which had yet to be stated. I don't know, Roland said. I almost hope not, because we can never be as we were. What? This time Cuthbert did rein up. Roland looked at him calmly enough, but now there were tears in his eyes. We are fools of Ka, the gunslinger said. Ka like a wind, Susan calls it. He looked first at Cuthbert on his left, then at Alen on his right. The tower is our Ka, mine especially, but it isn't hers, nor she mine. No more is John Farson our Ka. We're not going toward his men to defeat him, but only because they're in our way. He raised his hands, then dropped them again, as if to say, what more do you need me to tell you? There is no tower, Roland, Cuthbert said patiently. I don't know what you saw in that glass ball, but there is no tower. Well, as a symbol, I suppose, like Arthur's cup or the cross of the man Jesus, but not as a real thing, a real building, yes, Roland said. It's real. They looked at him uncertainly and saw no doubt on his face. It's real, and our fathers know. Beyond the Dark Land, I can't remember its name now, it's one of the things I've lost, is Endworld. And in Endworld stands the Dark Tower. Its existence is the great secret our fathers keep. It's what has held them together as Ka-Tet across all the years of the world's decline. When we return to Gilead, if we return, and I now think we will, I'll tell them what I've seen, and they'll confirm what I say. You saw all that in the glass? Alan asked in an awe-hushed voice. I saw much. But not Susan Delgado, Cuthbert said. No. When we finish with yonder men and she finishes with Magus, her part in our Ka-Tet ends. Inside the ball I was given a choice. Susan, and my life as her husband and father of the child she now carries, or the tower. Roland wiped his face with a shaking hand. I would choose Susan in an instant, if not for one thing. The tower is crumbling, and if it falls, everything we know will be swept away. There will be chaos beyond our imagining. We must go, and we will go. Above his young and unlined cheeks, below his young and unlined brow, were the ancient killer's eyes. that Eddie Dean would first glimpse in the mirror of an airliner's bathroom. But now they swam with childish tears. There was nothing childish in his voice, however. "I choose the tower. I must. Let her live a good life and long with someone else. She will in time. As for me, I choose the tower." XI. Susan mounted on pylon, which Shimi had hastened to bring around to the rear courtyard after lighting the draperies of the great parlor on fire. Olive Thorin rode one of the barony geldings, with Shimi double-mounted behind her and holding on to Cappy's lead. Maria opened the back gate, wished them good luck, and the three trotted out. The sun was westering now, but the wind had pulled away most of the smoke that had risen earlier. Whatever had happened in the desert, it was over now. Or happening on some other layer of the same present time.
"Roland, be thee well," Susan thought. "I'll see thee soon, dear, as soon as I can." "Why are we going north?" she asked, after half an hour's silent riding.
"Because Seacoast Road's best.
But hush! They'll find you gone and search the house first. If it hasn't burned flat, that is. Not finding you there, they'll send west along the Great Road."
She cast an eye on Susan that was not much like the dithery, slightly confabulated Olive Thorin that folks in Henry knew, or thought they knew.
"If I know that's the direction you'd choose, so will others we'd do well to avoid."
Susan was silent. She was too confused to speak, but Olive seemed to know what she was about, and Susan was grateful for that.
"By the time they get around to sniffing west, it'll be dark. Tonight we'll stay in one of the sea cliff caves 5 miles or so from here. I grew up a fisherman's daughter, and I know all those caves, none better."
The thought of the caves she'd played in as a girl seemed to cheer her.
"Tomorrow we'll cut west, as you like. I'm afraid you're going to have a plump old widow as a chaperone for a bit. Better get used to the idea."
"Thee's too good," Susan said.
"You should send Shimi and I on alone, Si."
"And go back to what? Why, I can't even get two old trailhands on kitchen duty to follow my orders. Fran Langill's boss of the shooting match now, and I've no urge to wait and see how he does at it. Nor if he decides he'd be better off with me adjudged mad and put up safe in a hussy with bars on the windows. Or shall I stay to see how Hash Renfrew does as mayor, with his boots up on my tables?"
Olive actually laughed.
"Si, I'm sorry."
"We shall all be sorry later on," Olive said, sounding remarkably cheery about it. "For now the most important thing is to reach those caves unobserved. It must seem that we vanished into thin air. Hold up."
Olive checked her horse, stood in the stirrups, looked around to make sure of her position, nodded, then twisted in the saddle so she could speak to Shimi.
"Young man, it's time for you to mount your trusty mule and go back to Seafront. If there are riders coming after us, you must turn them aside with a few well-chosen words. Will he do that?"
Shimi looked stricken.
"I don't have any well-chosen words, Si Thorin, so I don't. I hardly have any words at all."
"Nonsense," Olive said, and kissed Shimi's forehead. "Go back at a goodish trot. If you spy no one coming after us by the time the sun touches the hills, then turn north again and follow. We shall wait for you by the signpost. Do you know where I mean?"
Shimi thought he did, although it marked the outmost northern boundary of his little patch of geography.
"The red'un, with the sombrero on it, and the arrow pointing back for town?"
"The very one. You won't get that far until after dark, but there'll be plenty of moonlight tonight. If you don't come right away, we'll wait. But you must go back and shift any men that might be chasing us off our track. Do you understand?"
Shimi did. He slid off Olive's horse, clucked Capricoso forward, and climbed on board, wincing as the place the mule had bitten came down.
"So it'll be, Olive Si."
"Good, Shimi, good. Off you go, then."
"Shimi," Susan said, "come to me a moment, please."
He did, holding his hat in front of him and looking up at her worshipfully. Susan bent and kissed him, not on the forehead, but firmly on the mouth. Shimi came close to fainting.
"Thank you, Sai," Susan said, "for everything."
Shimi nodded. When he spoke, he could manage nothing above a whisper.
"'Twas only Ka," he said. "I know that. But I love you, Susan Sai. Go well. I'll see you soon.
I look forward to it."
But there was no soon, and no later for them either. Shimi took one look back as he rode his mule south and waved. Susan lifted her own hand in return. It was the last Shimi ever saw of her, and in many ways, that was a blessing. 12. The Tego had set pickets a mile out from Hanging Rock, but the blonde boy Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain encountered as they closed in on the tankers looked confused and unsure of himself, no danger to anyone. He had scurvy blossoms around his mouth and nose, suggesting that the men Farson had sent on this duty had ridden hard and fast, with little in the way of fresh supplies. When Cuthbert gave the good man Segul, hands clasped to the chest, left above right, then both held out to the person being greeted, the blonde picket did the same, and with a grateful smile.
"What's spinning Rary back there?"
he asked, speaking with a strong in-world accent. To Roland, the boy sounded like a Nordite.
"Three boys who killed a couple of big bugs and then hide for the hills," Cuthbert replied. He was an eerily good mimic, and gave the boy back his own accent faultlessly. "There were a fight. It'd be over now, but they did fight fearful."
"What no time," Roland said brusquely. "We have dispatches." He crossed his hands on his chest, then held them out. "Heil, Farson."
"Good man,"
the blonde returned smartly. He gave back the salute with a smile that said he would have asked Cuthbert where he was from and who he was related to if there had been more time. Then they were past him and inside Letigo's perimeter, as easy as that. "Remember that it's hit and run," Roland said. "Slow down for nothing. What we don't get must be left. There'll be no second pass."
"Gods, don't even suggest such a thing," Cuthbert said.
But he was smiling. He pulled his sling out of its rudimentary holster and tested its elastic draw with a thumb. Then he licked the thumb and hoisted it to the wind. Not much problem there, if they came in as they were. The wind was strong, but at their backs. Alain unslung Langill's machine gun, looked at it doubtfully, then yanked back the slide cock.
"I don't know about this, Roland. It's loaded, and I think I see how to use it, but then use it," Roland said.
The three of them were picking up speed now, the hooves of their horses drumming against the hard pan. The wind gusted, belling the fronts of their serapes. "This is the sort of work it was meant for. If it jams, drop it and use your revolver. Are you ready?"
"Yes, Roland."
"Bert?"
"Aye,"
Cuthbert said in a wildly exaggerated Hambry accent.
"So I am, so I am."
Ahead of them, dust puffed as groups of riders passed before and behind the tankers, readying the column for departure. Men on foot looked around at the oncomers curiously, but with a fatal lack of alarm. Roland drew both revolvers.
"Gilead!" he cried. "Heil, Gilead!"
He spurred Rusher to a gallop. The other two boys did the same. Cuthbert was in the middle again, sitting on his reins, slingshot in hand, Lucifer matches radiating out of his tightly pressed lips. The gunslingers rode down on Hanging Rock like furies. 13. 20 minutes after sending Shimi back south, Susan and Olive came around a sharp bend and found themselves face to face with three mounted men in the road. In the late slanting sun, she saw that the one in the middle had a blue coffin tattooed on his hand. It was Reynolds. Susan's heart sank. The one on Reynolds's left, he wore a stained white drover's hat and had a lazily cocked eye, she didn't know. But the one on the right, who looked like a stony-hearted preacher, was Laszlo Reimer. It was Reimer that Reynolds glanced at after smiling at Susan.
"Why, Laz and I couldn't even get us a drink to send his late brother, the Chancellor of whatever you want, and the Minister of Thank You Very Much on with a word," Reynolds said. We hadn't hardly hit town before we got persuaded out here. I wasn't going to go, but damn, that old lady's something. Could talk a corpse into giving a blowjob, if you'll pardon the crudity.
I think your aunt may have lost a wheel or two off her cart, though, sighed Delgado. Your friends are dead, Susan told him. Reynolds paused, shrugged.
Well, now, maybe see and maybe no. Me, I think I've decided to travel on without them even if they ain't. But I might hang around here one more night. This reaping business, I've heard so much about the way folks do it in the Otters. Especially the bonfire part.
The man with the cocked eye laughed phlegmily.
Let us pass, Olive said. This girl has done nothing, and neither have I.
She helped Dearborn escape, Reimer said. Him who murdered your own husband and my brother. I wouldn't call that nothing.
The gods may restore Kimber Reimer in the clearing, Olive said, but the truth is he looted half of this town's treasury, and what he didn't give over to John Farson he kept for himself.
Reimer recoiled as if slapped.
He didn't know I knew. Laszlo, I'd be angry at how little any of you thought of me, except why would I want to be thought of by the likes of you anyway? I knew enough to make me sick. Leave it at that. I know that the man you're sitting beside,
shut up, Reimer muttered,
was likely the one who cut your brother's black heart open. Cy Reynolds was seen that early morning in that wing, so I've been told.
Shut up, you cunt!
And so I believe.
Better do as he says, Cy, and hold your tongue, Reynolds said.
Some of the lazy good humor had left his face, Susan thought.
He doesn't like people knowing what he did, not even when he's the one on top and what they know can't hurt him. And he's less without Jonas, a lot less. He knows it, too.
Let us pass, Olive said.
No, Si, I can't do that.
I'll help you then, shall I?
Her hand had crept beneath the outrageously large serape during the palaver, and now she brought out a huge and ancient pistola. Its handles of yellowed ivory, its filigreed barrel of old tarnished silver. On top was a brass powder and spark. Olive had no business even drawing the thing. It caught in her serape, and she had to fight it free. She had no business cocking it either, a process that took both thumbs and two tries. But the three men were utterly flummoxed by the sight of the elderly blunderbuss in her hands, Reynolds as much as the other two. He sat his horse with his jaw hanging slack. Jonas would have wept.
Get her!
A cracked old voice shrieked from behind the men blocking the road.
What's wrong with you, you stupid culls? Get her!
Reynolds started at that and went for his gun. He was fast, but he had given Olive too much of a head start and was beaten, beaten cold. Even as he cleared leather with the barrel of his revolver, the mayor's widow held the old gun out in both hands and, squinching her eyes shut like a little girl who was forced to eat something nasty, pulled the trigger. The spark flashed, but the damp powder only made a weary floop sound and disappeared in a puff of blue smoke. The ball, big enough to have taken Clay Reynolds's head off from the nose on up had it fired, stayed in the barrel. In the next instant, his own gun roared in his fist. Olive's horse reared, whinnying. Olive went off the gelding, head over boots, with a black hole in the orange stripe of her serape, the stripe which lay above her heart. Susan heard herself screaming. The sound seemed to come from very far away. She might have gone on for some time, but then she heard the clop of approaching pony hooves from behind the men in the road, and knew. Even before the man with the lazy eye moved aside to show her, she knew, and her screams stopped. The galloped-out pony that had brought the witch back to Hambry had been replaced by a fresh one. But it was the same black cart, the same golden cabalistic symbols, the same driver. Rhea sat with the reins in her claws, her head ticking from side to side like the head of a rusty old robot, grinning at Susan without humor, grinning as a corpse grins.
"Hello, my little sweeting," she said, calling her as she had all those months ago, on the night Susan had come to her hut to be proved honest, on the night Susan had come running most of the way out of simple high spirits. Beneath the light of the kissing moon she had come, her blood high from the exercise, her skin flushed. She had been singing Careless Love. "Your pallies and screw buddies have taken my ball, you ken," Rhea said, clucking the pony to a stop a few paces ahead of the riders. Even Reynolds looked down on her with uneasiness. "Took my lovely glam. That's what those bad boys did. Those bad, bad boys. But it showed me much while yet I had it, aye. It sees far, and in more ways than one. Much of it I forgot. But not which way he'd come, my sweeting. Not which way that precious old dead bitch laying yonder on the road would bring you. And now you must go to town."
Her grin widened, became something unspeakable.
"It's time for the fair, you ken."
"Let me go," Susan said. "Let me go if ye had not answer to Roland of Gilead." Rhea ignored her and spoke to Reynolds.
"Bind her hands before her and stand her in the back of the cart. There's people that'll want to see her. A good look is what they'll want, and a good look is just what they'll have. If her aunt's done a proper job, there'll be a lot of 'em in town. Get her up now and be smart about it."
14. Alain had time for one clear thought. We could have gone around them. If what Roland said is true, then only the wizard's glass matters, and we have that. We could have gone around them. Except, of course, that was impossible. 100 generations of gunslinger blood argued against it. Tower or no tower, the thieves must not be allowed to have their prize, not if they could be stopped. Alain leaned forward and spoke directly into his horse's ear. "Jig or rear when I start shooting and I'll knock your fucking brains out." Roland led them in, outracing the other two on his stronger horse. The clot of men nearest by, 5 or 6 mounted, 12 or more on foot, and examining a pair of the oxen which had dragged the tankers out here, gazed at him stupidly until he began to fire, and then they scattered like quail. He got every one of the riders. Their horses fled in a widening fan, trailing their reins, and in one case a dead soldier. Somewhere someone was shouting, "Harriers! Harriers! Mount up, you fools!" "Alain!" Roland screamed as they bore down. In front of the tankers, a double handful of riders and armed men were coming together, milling together in a clumsy defensive line. "Now! Now!" Alain raised the machine gun, seated its rusty wire stock in the hollow of his shoulder, and remembered what little he knew about rapid-fire weapons. Aim low, swing fast and smooth. He touched the trigger, and the speed shooter bellowed into the dusty air, recoiling against his shoulder in a series of rapid thuds, shooting bright fire from the end of its perforated barrel. Alain raked it from left to right, running the sight above the scattering, shouting defenders and across the high steel hides of the tankers. The third tanker actually blew up on its own. The sound it made was like no explosion Alain had ever heard, a guttural, muscular, ripping sound accompanied by a brilliant flash of orange-red fire. The steel shell rose in 2 halves. One of these spun 30 yards through the air and landed on the desert floor in a furiously burning hulk. The other rose straight up into a column of greasy black smoke. A burning wooden wheel spun across the sky like a plate and came back down trailing sparks and burning splinters. Men fled, screaming, some on foot, others laid flat along the necks of their nags, their eyes wide and panicky. When Alain reached the end of the line of tankers, he reversed the track of the muzzle. The machine gun was hot in his hands now, but he kept his finger pressed to the trigger. In this world, you had to use what you could while it still worked. Beneath him, his horse ran on, as if it had understood every word Alain had whispered in its ear. "Another! I want another!" But before he could blow another tanker, the gun ceased its chatter, perhaps jammed, probably empty. Alain threw it aside and drew his revolver. From beside him there came the thump of Cuthbert's slingshot, audible even over the cries of the men, the hoofbeats of the horses, the whoosh of the burning tanker. Alain saw a sputtering big bang arc into the sky and come down exactly where Cuthbert had aimed, in the oil puddling around the wooden wheels of a tanker marked Sunoco. For a moment, Alain could clearly see the line of 9 or 12 holes in the tanker's bright side, holes he had put there with Cy Lengel's speed shooter, and then there was a crack and a flash as the big bang exploded. A moment later, the holes running along the bright flank of the tanker began to shimmer. The oil beneath them was on fire. "Get out!" a man in a faded campaign hat yelled. "She's going to blow! They're all going to blow!" Alain shot him, exploding the side of his face and knocking him out of one old sprung boot. A moment later, the second tanker blew up. One burning steel panel shot out sidewards, landed in the growing puddle of crude oil beneath a third tanker, and then that one exploded as well. Black smoke rose in the air like the fumes of a funeral pyre. It darkened the day and drew an oily veil across the sun. XV. All 6 of Farson's chief lieutenants had been carefully described to Roland, to all 14 gunslingers in training, and he recognized the man running for the Remuda at once, George Letigo. Roland could have shot him as he ran, but that, ironically, would have made possible a getaway that was cleaner than he wanted. Instead, he shot the man who ran to meet him. Letigo wheeled on the heels of his boots and stared at Roland with blazing, hate-filled eyes. Then he ran again, hailing another man, shouting for the riders who were huddled together beyond the burning zone. 2 more tankers exploded, whamming at Roland's eardrums with dull iron fists, seeming to suck the air back from his lungs like a riptide. The plan had been for Alain to perforate the tankers and for Cuthbert to then shoot in a steady, arcing stream of big bangers, lighting the spilling oil. The one big banger he actually shot seemed to confirm that the plan had been feasible, but it was the last slingshot work Cuthbert did that day. The ease with which the gunslingers had gotten inside the enemy's perimeter and the confusion which greeted their original charge could have been chalked up to inexperience and exhaustion, but the placing of the tankers had been Letigo's mistake, and his alone. He had drawn them tight without even thinking about it, and now they blew tight, one after another. Once the conflagration began, there was no chance of stopping it. Even before Roland raised his left arm and circled it in the air, signaling for Alain and Cuthbert to break off, the work was done. Letigo's encampment was an oily inferno, and John Farson's plans for a motorized assault were so much black smoke being tattered apart by the fin de año wind.
"Ride!" Roland screamed. "Ride, ride, ride!"
They spurred west toward Eyebolt Canyon. As they went, Roland felt a single bullet drone past his left ear. It was, so far as he knew, the only shot fired at any of them during the assault on the tankers. 16. Letigo was in an ecstasy of fury, a perfect brain-bursting rage, and that was probably merciful. It kept him from thinking of what the good man would do when he learned of this fiasco. For the time being, all Letigo cared about was catching the men who had ambushed him, if an ambush in desert country was even possible. Men? No. The boys who had done this. Letigo knew who they were, all right. He didn't know how they had gotten out here, but he knew who they were, and their run would stop right here, east of the woods and rising hills.
"Hendricks!" he bawled.
Hendricks had at least managed to hold his men, 6 of them, all mounted near the Remuda.
"Hendricks, to me!"
As Hendricks rode toward him, Letigo spun the other way and saw a huddle of men standing and watching the burning tankers. Their gaping mouths and stupid young sheep faces made him feel like screaming and dancing up and down, but he refused to give in to that. He held a narrow beam of concentration, one aimed directly at the raiders, who must not, under any circumstances, be allowed to escape.
"You!"
he shouted at the men. One of them turned. The others did not. Letigo strode to them, drawing his pistol as he went. He slapped it into the hand of the man who had turned toward the sound of his voice and pointed at random to one of those who had not. "Shoot that fool!" Dazed, his face that of a man who believes he is dreaming, the soldier raised the pistol and shot the man to whom Letigo had pointed. That unlucky fellow went down in a heap of knees and elbows and twitching hands. The others turned.
"Good!" Letigo said, taking his gun back.
"Sir," Hendricks cried. "I see them, sir. I have the enemy in clear view." Two more tankers exploded. A few wickering shards of steel flew in their direction. Some of the men ducked. Letigo did not so much as twitch, nor did Hendricks. A good man. Thank God for at least one such in this nightmare.
"Shall I hie after them, sir?" "I'll take your men and hie after them myself, Hendricks. Mount those hoss guts before us."
He swept an arm at the standing men, whose doltish attention had been diverted from the burning tankers to their dead comrade.
"Pull in as many others as you can. Do you have a bugler?"
"Yes, sir. Range, sir."
Hendricks looked around, beckoned, and a pimply, scared-looking boy rode forward. A dented bugle on a frayed strap hung askew on the front of his shirt.
"Range," Letigo said, "you're with Hendricks."
"Yes, sir."
"Get as many men as you can, Hendricks, but don't linger over the job. They're headed for that canyon, and I believe someone told me it's a box. If so, we're going to turn it into a shooting gallery."
Hendricks's lips spread in a twisted grin.
"Yes, sir."
Behind them, the tankers continued to explode. 17. Roland glanced back and was astonished by the size of the black, smoky column rising into the air. Ahead, he could clearly see the brush blocking most of the canyon's mouth. And although the wind was blowing the wrong way, he could now hear the maddening mosquito whine of the thinny. He patted the air with his outstretched hands, signaling for Cuthbert and Alain to slow down. While they were both still looking at him, he took off his bandana, whipped it into a rope, and tied it so it would cover his ears. They copied him. It was better than nothing. The gunslingers continued west, their shadows now running out behind them as long as gantries on the desert floor. Looking back, Roland could see two groups of riders streaming in pursuit. Letigo was at the head of the first, Roland thought, and he was deliberately holding his riders back a little so that the two groups could merge and attack together. Good, he thought. The three of them rode toward Eyebolt in a tight line, continuing to hold their own horses in, allowing their pursuers to close the distance. Every now and then, another thud smote the air and shivered through the ground as one of the remaining tankers blew up. Roland was amazed at how easy it had been. Even after the battle with Jonas and Lengel, which should have put the men out here on their mettle, it had been easy. It made him think of a Reaptide long ago, he and Cuthbert surely no more than 7 years old, running along a line of stuffy guys with sticks, knocking them over one after the other. Bang, bang, bangity, bang. The sound of the thinny was warbling its way into his brain in spite of the bandana over his ears, making his eyes water. Behind him he could hear the whoops and shouts of the pursuing men. It delighted him. Letigo's men had counted the odds, 24 against 3, with many more of their own force riding hard to join the battle, and their peckers were up once more. Roland faced front and pointed Rusher at the slit in the brush marking the entrance to Eyebolt Canyon. 18. Hendricks fell in beside Letigo, breathing hard, cheeks glaring with color.
"Sir, beg to report."
"Then do it.
I have 20 men, and they're perhaps 3 times that number riding hard to join us."
Letigo ignored all of this. His eyes were bright blue flecks of ice. Under his mustache was a small, greedy smile.
"Rodney," he said, speaking Hendricks's first name almost with the caress of a lover.
"Sir?" "I think they're going in, Rodney."
"Yes. Look, I'm sure of it. 2 more minutes and it'll be too late for them to turn back."
He raised his gun, laid the muzzle across his forearm, and threw a shot at the 3 riders ahead, mostly in exuberance.
"Yes, sir. Very good, sir."
Hendricks turned and waved viciously for his men to close up, close up. 19.
"Dismount," Roland shouted when they reached the line of tangled brush.
It had a smell that was at once dry and oily, like a fire waiting to happen. He didn't know if their failure to ride their horses into the canyon would put Letigo's wind up or not, and he didn't care. These were good mounts, fine Gilead stock, and over these last months Rusher had become his friend. He would not take him or any of the horses into the canyon, where they would be caught between the fire and the thinny. The boys were off the horses in a flash, Alen pulling the drawstring bag free of his saddle horn and slinging it over one shoulder. Cuthbert's and Alan's horses ran at once, whinnying, parallel to the brush. But Rusher lingered for a moment, looking at Roland. "Go on," Roland slapped him on the flank. "Run." Rusher ran, tails streaming out behind him. Cuthbert and Alan slipped through the break in the brush. Roland followed, glancing down to make sure that the powder trail was still there. It was, and still dry. There had been not a drop of rain since the day they'd laid it. "Cuthbert," he said, "matches." Cuthbert gave him some. He was grinning so hard it was a wonder they hadn't fallen out of his mouth. "We warmed up their day, didn't we, Roland?" "Aye." "We did indeed," Roland said, grinning himself. "Go on now, back to that chimney cut."
"Let me do it," Cuthbert said. "Please, Roland, you go with Alen and let me stay. I'm a firebug at heart, always have been."
"No," Roland said. "This part of it's mine. Don't argue with me, go on. And tell Alen to mind the wizard's glass no matter what." Cuthbert looked at him for a moment longer, then nodded. "Don't wait too long." "I won't."
"May your luck rise, Roland."
"May yours rise twice." Cuthbert hurried away, boots rattling on the loose stone which carpeted the floor of the canyon. He reached Alen, who lifted a hand to Roland. Roland nodded back, then ducked as a bullet snapped close enough to his temple to flick his hat brim. He crouched to the left of the opening in the brush and peered around, the wind now striking full in his face. Letigo's men were closing rapidly, more rapidly than he had expected. If the wind blew out the Lucifers... Never mind the ifs. Hold on, Roland. Hold on. Wait for them. He held on, hunkering with an unlit match in each hand, now peering out through a tangle of interlaced branches. The smell of mesquite was strong in his nostrils. Not far behind it was the reek of burning oil. The drone of the thinny filled his head, making him feel dizzy, a stranger to himself. He thought of how it had been inside the pink storm, flying through the air, how he had been snatched away from his vision of Susan. "Thank God for Shimi," he thought distantly. "He'll make sure she finishes the day someplace safe." But the craven whine of the thinny seemed somehow to mock him, to ask him if there had been more to see. Now Letigo and his men were crossing the last 300 yards to the canyon's mouth at a full-out gallop, the ones behind closing up fast. It would be hard for the ones riding point to stop suddenly without the risk of being ridden down. It was time. Roland stuck one of the Lucifers between his front teeth and raked it forward. It lit, spilling one hot and sour spark onto the wet bed of his tongue. Before the Lucifer's head could burn away, Roland touched it to the powder in the trench. It lit at once, running left beneath the north end of the brush in a bright yellow thread. He lunged across the opening, which might be wide enough for two horses running flank to flank, with the second Lucifer already poised behind his teeth. He struck it as soon as he was somewhat blocked from the wind, dropped it into the powder, heard the splutter hiss, then turned and ran. 20. "Mother and father," was Roland's first shocked thought, memory so deep and unexpected it was like a slap. At Lake Saroni. When had they gone there? To beautiful Lake Saroni in the northern part of Gilead Barony. That Roland couldn't remember. He knew only that he had been very small, and that there had been a beautiful stretch of sandy beach for him to play on, perfect for an aspiring young castle builder such as he. That was what he had been doing on one day of their vacation. Was it a vacation? Did my parents once upon a time actually take a vacation trip? And he had looked up. Something, maybe only the cries of the birds circling over the lake, had made him look up. And there were his mother and father, Stephen and Gabrielle Deschaine, at the water's edge, standing with their backs to him and their arms around each other's waists, looking out at blue water beneath a blue summer sky. How his heart had filled with love for them. How infinite was love, twining in and out of hope and memory, like a braid with three strong strands, so much the bright tower of every human's life and soul. It wasn't love he felt now, however, but terror. The figure standing before him as he ran back to where the canyon ended, where the rational part of the canyon ended, weren't Stephen of Gilead and Gabrielle of Arton, but his mollies, Cuthbert and Alain. They didn't have their arms around each other's waists either, but their hands were clasped, like the hands of fairy tale children lost in a threatening fairy tale wood. Birds circled, but they were vultures, not gulls, and the shimmering, mist-topped stuff before the two boys wasn't water. It was the Thinny. And as Roland watched, Cuthbert and Alain began to walk toward it.
"Stop!" he screamed. "For your father's sake, stop!"
They did not stop. They walked hand in hand toward the white-edged hem of the smoky green shimmer. The Thinny whined its pleasure, murmured endearments, promised rewards. It baked the nerves numb and picked at the brain. There was no time to reach them, so Roland did the only thing he could think of, raised one of his guns, and fired it over their heads. The report was a hammer blow in the canyon's enclosure, and for a moment the ricochet whine was louder than that of the Thinny. The two boys stopped only inches from its sick shimmer. Roland kept expecting it to reach out and grab them, as it had grabbed the low-flying bird when they had been here on the night of the peddler's moon. He triggered two more shots into the air, the reports hitting the walls and rolling back.
"Gunslingers!" he cried. "To me! To me!"
It was Alain who turned toward him first, his dazed eyes seeming to float in his dust-streaked face. Cuthbert continued forward another step, the tips of his boots disappearing in the greenish-silver froth at the edge of the Thinny. The whinging grumble of the thing rose half a note, as if in anticipation, and then Alain yanked him back by the tug-string of his sombrero. Cuthbert tripped over a good-sized chunk of fallen rock and landed hard. When he looked up, his eyes had cleared.
"Gods!" he murmured,
and as he scrambled to his feet, Roland saw that the toes of his boots were gone, clipped off neatly as if with a pair of gardening shears. His great toes stuck out.
"Roland!" he gasped as he and Alain stumbled toward him. "Roland! We were almost gone! It talks!"
"Yes, I've heard it. Come on, there's no time." He led them to the notch in the canyon wall, praying that they could get up quick enough to avoid being riddled with bullets, as they certainly would be if Letigo arrived before they could get up at least part of the way. A smell, acrid and bitter, began to fill the air, an odor like boiling juniper berries, and the first tendrils of whitish-gray smoke drifted past them. "Cuthbert, you first. Alain, you next. I'll come last. Climb fast, boys. Climb for your lives!" Letigo's men poured through the slot in the wall of brush like water pouring into a funnel, gradually widening the gap as they came. The bottom layer of the dead vegetation was already on fire, but in their excitement none of them saw those first low flames, or marked them if they did. The pungent smoke also went unnoticed. Their noses had been deadened by the colossal stench of the burning oil. Letigo himself, in the lead, with Hendricks close behind, had only one thought. Two words that pounded at his brain in a kind of vicious triumph. Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Yet something began to intrude on this mantra as he galloped deeper into Eyebolt, his horse's hooves clattering nimbly through the scree of rocks and bones, whitish piles of cow skulls and rib cages. This was a kind of low buzzing, a maddening, slobbering whine, insectile and insistent. It made his eyes water. Yet strong as the sound was, if it was a sound, it almost seemed to be coming from inside him, he pushed it aside, holding onto his mantra, "Box Canyon, Box Canyon," got him in a Box Canyon instead. He would have to face Walter when this was over, perhaps Farson himself, and he had no idea what his punishment would be for losing the tankers, but all that was for later. Now he wanted only to kill these interfering bastards. Up ahead, the canyon took a jog to the north. They would be beyond that point, and probably not far beyond either, backed up against the canyon's final wall, trying to squeeze themselves behind what fallen rocks there might be. Letigo would mass what guns he had and drive them out into the open with ricochets. They would probably come with their hands up, hoping for mercy. They would hope in vain. After what they'd done, the trouble they'd caused, as Letigo rode around the jog in the canyon's wall, already leveling his pistol, his horse screamed, like a woman it screamed, and reared beneath him. Letigo caught the saddle horn and managed to stay up, but the horse's rear hooves slid sideways in the scree, and the animal went down. Letigo let go of the horn and threw himself clear, already aware that the sound which had been creeping into his ears was suddenly 10 times stronger, buzzing, loud enough to make his eyeballs pulse in their sockets, loud enough to make his balls tingle unpleasantly, loud enough to blot out the mantra which had been beating so insistently in his head. The insistence of the finny was far, far greater than any George Letigo could have managed. Horses flashed around him as he landed in a kind of sprawling squat, horses that were shoved forward willy-nilly by the oncoming press from behind, by riders that squeezed through the gap in pairs, then trios as the hole in the brush, now burning all along its length, widened, and then spread out again once they were past the bottleneck, none of them clearly realizing that the entire canyon was a bottleneck. Letigo got a confused glimpse of black tails and gray forelegs and dappled fetlocks. He saw chaps and jeans and boots jammed into stirrups. He tried to get up, and a horseshoe clanged against the back of his skull. His hat saved him from unconsciousness, but he went heavily to his knees with his head down, like a man who means to pray, his vision full of stars, and the back of his neck instantly soaked with blood from the gash the passing hoof had opened in his scalp. Now he heard more screaming horses, screaming men as well. He got up again, coughing out the dust raised by the passing horses, such acrid dust, too, it clawed his throat like smoke, and saw Hendricks trying to spur his horse south and east against the oncoming tide of riders. He couldn't do it. The rear third of the canyon was some sort of swamp filled with greenish, steaming water, and there must be quicksand beneath it because Hendricks's horse seemed stuck. It screamed again and tried to rear. Its hindquarters slewed sideways. Hendricks crashed his boots into the animal's sides again and again, attempting to get it in motion, but the horse didn't, or couldn't, move. That hungry buzzing sound filled Letigo's ears and seemed to fill the world.
"Back! Turn back!"
He tried to scream the words, but they came out in what was little more than a croak. Still the riders pounded past him, raising dust that was too thick to be only dust. Letigo pulled in breath so he could scream louder. They had to go back. Something was dreadfully wrong in Eyebolt Canyon, and hacked it out without saying anything. Screaming horses, reeking smoke, and everywhere, filling the world like lunacy, that whining, whinging, cringing buzz. Hendricks's horse went down, eyes rolling, bit-parted teeth snapping at the smoky air and splattering curds of foam from its lips. Hendricks fell into the steaming, stagnant water, and it wasn't water at all. It came alive somehow as he struck it, grew green hands and a green, shifty mouth, pawed his cheek and melted away the flesh, pawed his nose and tore it off, pawed at his eyes and stripped them from their sockets. It pulled Hendricks under, but before it did, Letigo saw his denuded jawbone, a bloody piston to drive his screaming teeth. Other men saw and tried to wheel away from the green trap. Those who managed to do so in time were broadsided by the next wave of men, some of whom were, incredibly, still yipping or bellowing full-throated battle cries. More horses and riders were driven into the green shimmer, which accepted them eagerly. Letigo, standing stunned and bleeding like a man in the middle of a stampede, which was exactly what he was, saw the soldier to whom he had given his gun. This fellow, who had obeyed Letigo's order and shot one of his compadres in order to awaken the rest of them, threw himself from his saddle, howling, and crawled back from the edge of the green stuff even as his horse plunged in. He tried to get to his feet, saw two riders bearing down on him, and clapped his hands across his face. A moment later, he was ridden down. The shrieks of the wounded and dying echoed in the smoky canyon, but Letigo hardly heard them. What he heard mostly was that buzzing, a sound that was almost a voice, inviting him to jump in, to end it here. Why not? It was over, wasn't it? All over. He struggled away instead, and was now able to make some headway. The stream of riders packing its way into the canyon was easing. Some of the riders 50 or 60 yards back from the jog had even been able to turn their horses. But these were ghostly and confused in the thickening smoke. "The cunning bastards have set the brush on fire behind us! Gods of heaven, gods of earth, I think we're trapped in here!" He could give no commands. Every time he drew in breath to try, he coughed it wordlessly back out again. But he was able to grab a passing rider, who looked all of 17, and yank him out of his saddle. The boy went down head first and smashed his brow open on a jutting chunk of rock. Letigo was mounted in his place before the kid's feet had stopped twitching. He jerked the horse's head around and spurred for the front of the canyon, but the smoke thickened to a choking white cloud before he got more than 20 yards. The wind was driving it this way. Letigo could make out barely the shifting orange glare of the burning brush at the desert end. He wheeled his new horse back the way it had come. More horses loomed out of the fog. Letigo crashed into one of them and was thrown for the second time in 5 minutes. He landed on his knees, scrambled to his feet, and staggered back downwind, coughing and retching, eyes red and streaming. It was a little better beyond the canyon's northward jog, but wouldn't be for much longer. The edge of the thinny was a tangle of milling horses, many with broken legs, and crawling, shrieking men. Letigo saw several hats floating on the greenish surface of the whining organism that filled the back of the canyon. He saw boots, he saw wristlets, he saw neckerchiefs, he saw the bugle boy's dented instrument still trailing its frayed strap. "Come in," the green shimmer invited, and Letigo found its buzz strangely attractive, intimate, almost. "Come in and visit. Squat and hunker. Be at rest. Be at peace. Be at one." Letigo raised his gun, meaning to shoot it. He didn't believe it could be killed, but he would remember the face of his father and go down shooting all the same. Except he didn't. The gun dropped from his relaxing fingers, and he walked forward. Others around him were now doing the same, into the thinny. The buzzing rose and rose, filling his ears until there was nothing else. Nothing else at all. They saw it all from the notch, where Roland and his friends had stopped in a strung-out line about 20 feet below the top. They saw the screaming confusion, the panicky milling, the men who were trampled, the men and horses that were driven into the thinny, and the men who, at the end, walked willingly into it. Cuthbert was closest to the top of the canyon's wall, then Alain, then Roland, standing on a 6-inch shelf of rock and holding an outcrop just above him. From their vantage point, they could see what the men struggling in their smoky hell below them could not. That the thinny was growing, reaching out, crawling eagerly toward them like an incoming tide. Roland, his battle lust slaked, did not want to watch what was happening below. But he couldn't turn away. The whine of the thinny, cowardly and triumphant at the same time, happy and sad at the same time, lost and found at the same time, held him like sweet, sticky ropes. He hung where he was, hypnotized, as did his friends above him, even when the smoke began to rise and its pungent tang made him cough dryly. Men shrieked their lives away in the thickening smoke below. They struggled in it like phantoms. They faded as the fog thickened, climbing the canyon walls like water. Horses whinnied desperately from beneath that acrid white death. The wind swirled its surface in prankish whirlpools. The thinny buzzed. And above where it lay, the surface of the smoke was stained a mystic shade of palest green. Then, at long last, John Farson's men screamed no more. We killed them, Roland thought with a kind of sick and fascinated horror. Then, no, not we, I killed them. How long he might have stayed there, Roland didn't know. Perhaps until the rising smoke engulfed him as well. But then Cuthbert, who had begun to climb again, called down three words from above him, called down in a tone of surprise and dismay.
Roland! The moon!
Roland looked up, startled, and saw that the sky had darkened to a velvety purple. His friend was outlined against it and looking east, his face stained fever orange with the light of the rising moon. Yes, orange, the thinny buzzed inside his head, laughed inside his head. Orange as 'twas when it rose on the night you came out here to see me and count me. Orange like a fire, orange like a bonfire.
How can it be almost dark? He cried inside himself, but he knew. Yes, he knew very well. Time had slipped back together. That was all like layers of ground embracing once more after the argument of an earthquake. Twilight had come. Moonrise had come. Terror struck Roland like a closed fist aimed at the heart, making him jerk backward on the small ledge he'd found. He groped for the horn-shaped outcrop above him, but that act of rebalancing was far away. Most of him was inside the pink storm again, before he had been snatched away and shown half the cosmos. Perhaps the wizard's glass had only shown him what stood worlds far away in order to keep from showing him what might soon befall so close to home. I'd turn around if I thought her life was in any real danger, he had said, in a second. And if the ball knew that? If it couldn't lie, might it not misdirect? Might it not take him away and show him a dark land, a darker tower? And it had shown him something else, something that recurred to him only now, a scrawny man in farmer's overalls who had said, what? Not quite what he'd thought, not what he had been used to hearing all his life, not life for you and life for your crop, but death, he whispered to the stones surrounding him. Death for you, life for my crop. Charyu tree. That's what he said. Charyu tree, come reap.
Orange, gunslinger.
A cracked old voice laughed inside his head. The voice of the coos.
The color of bonfires. Charyu tree, finde anyo. These are the old ways of which only the stuffy guys with their red hands remain. Until tonight. Tonight the old ways are refreshed, as the old ways must be from time to time. Charyu tree, you damned babby, Charyu tree! Tonight you pay for my sweet Ermac. Tonight you pay for all. Come, reap!
Climb! He screamed, reaching up and slapping Alan's behind. Climb, climb, for your father's sake, climb!
Roland, what... Alain's voice was dazed, but he did begin to climb, going from handhold to handhold and rattling small pebbles down into Roland's upturned face. Squinting against their fall, Roland reached and swatted Al's bottom again, driving him like a horse.
"Climb, goddamn you!" he cried. "It mayn't be too late, even now!"
But he knew better. Demon moon had risen. He had seen its orange light shining on Cuthbert's face like delirium, and he knew better. In his head, the lunatic buzz of the thinny, that rotting sore eating through the flesh of reality, joined with the lunatic laughter of the witch, and he knew better. Death for you, life for the crop, Charyu tree. Oh, Susan. 23. Nothing was clear to Susan until she saw the man with the long red hair and the straw hat which did not quite obscure his lamb-slaughterer's eyes. The man with the corn-shucks in his hands. He was the first. Just a farmer, she had glimpsed him in the lower market, she thought, had even nodded to him, as country folk do, and he back to her, standing by himself, not far from the place where Silk Ranch Road and the Great Road intersected, standing in the light of the rising moon. Until they came upon him, nothing was clear. After he hurled his bundle of corn shucks at her as she passed, standing in the slowly rolling cart with her hands bound in front of her and her head lowered and a rope around her neck, everything was clear.
"Char-you-tree,"
he called, almost sweetly uttering words of the old people she hadn't heard since her childhood, words that meant come reap, and something else as well. Something hidden, something secret, something to do with that root word, char, that word which meant only death. As the dried shucks fluttered around her boots, she understood the secret very well. Understood also that there would be no baby for her, no wedding for her in the fairy distant land of Gilead, no hall in which she and Roland would be joined and then saluted beneath the electric lights, no husband, no more nights of sweet love. All that was over. The world had moved on, and all that was over. Done before fairly begun. She knew that she had been put in the back of the cart, stood in the back of the cart, and that the surviving coffin hunter had looped a noose around her neck. "Don't try to sit," he had said, sounding almost apologetic. "I have no desire to choke you, girlie. If the wagon bumps and you fall, I'll try to keep the knot loose, but if you try to sit, I have to give you a pension. Her orders." He nodded to Rhea, who sat erect on the seat of the cart, the reins in her warped hands. "She's in charge now." And so she had been. So, as they neared town, she still was. Whatever the possession of her glam had done to her body, whatever the loss of it had done to her mind, it had not broken her power. That seemed to have increased, if anything, as if she'd found some other source from which she could feed, at least for a while. Men who could have broken her over one knee like a stick of kindling followed her commands as unquestioningly as children. There were more and more men as that reaping afternoon wound its shallow course to night. Half a dozen ahead of the cart riding with Reimer and the man with the cocked eye, a full dozen riding behind it, with Reynolds, the rope leading to her neck wound around his tattooed hand, at their head. She didn't know who these men were or how they had been summoned. Rhea had taken this rapidly increasing party north a little farther, then turned southwest on the old Silk Ranch Road, which wound back toward town. On the eastern edge of Hambry, it rejoined the Great Road. Even in her dazed state, Susan had realized the Harridan was moving slowly, measuring the descent of the sun as they went, not clucking at the pony to hurry, but actually reining it in, at least until afternoon's gold had gone. When they passed the farmer, thin-faced and alone, a good man, no doubt, with a freehold farm he worked hard from first gleam to last glow, and a family he loved, but oh, there were those lamb-slaughterer eyes below the brim of his battered hat. She understood this leisurely course of travel, too. Rhea had been waiting for the moon. With no gods to pray to, Susan prayed to her father. "Da, if these there help me to be strong as I can be, and help me hold to him, to the memory of him, help me hold to myself as well, not for rescue, not for salvation, but just so as not to give them the satisfaction of seeing my pain and my fear. And him, help him as well. Help keep him safe," she whispered. "Keep my love safe. Take my love safe to where he goes. Give him joy in who he sees, and make him a cause of joy in those who see him."
"Prayin', dearie?"
the old woman asked without turning on the seat. Her croaking voice oozed false compassion.
"Aye, you do well to make things right with the powers while you still can. Before the spit's burned right out of your throat!"
She threw back her head and cackled, the straggling remains of her broom-straw hair flying out orange in the light of the bloated moon. 24. Their horses, led by Rusher, had come to the sound of Roland's dismayed shout. They stood not far away, their manes rippling in the wind, shaking their heads and whinnying their displeasure whenever the wind dropped enough for them to get a whiff of the thick white smoke rising from the canyon. Roland paid no attention to the horses or the smoke. His eyes were fixed on the drawstring sack slung over Alain's shoulder. The ball inside had come alive again. In the growing dark, the bag seemed to pulse like some weird pink firefly. He held out his hands for it. Give it to me.
Roland, I don't know if... Give it to me, damn your face!
Alan looked at Cuthbert, who nodded, then lifted his hands skyward in a weary, distracted gesture. Roland tore the bag away before Alan could do more than begin to shrug it off his shoulder. The gunslinger dipped into it and pulled the glass out. It was glowing fiercely, a pink demon moon instead of an orange one. Behind and below them, the nagging whine of the thinny rose and fell, rose and fell.
"Don't look directly into that thing," Cuthbert muttered to Alan. "Don't, for your father's sake."
Roland bent his face over the pulsing ball, its light running over his cheeks and brow like liquid, drowning his eyes in its dazzle. In Merlin's rainbow, he saw her. Susan, horse drover's daughter, lovely girl at the window. He saw her standing in the back of a black cart decorated with gold symbols, the old witch's cart. Reynolds rode behind her, holding the end of a rope that was noosed around her neck. The cart was rolling toward Greenheart, making its way with processional slowness. Hill Street was lined with people, of whom the farmer with the lamb slaughterer's eyes had been only the first, all those folk of Hambry and Magus who had been deprived of their fare, but were now given this ancient dark attraction in its stead. Char you tree, come reap, death for you, life for our crops. A soundless whispering ran through them like a gathering wave, and they began to pelter first with corn husks, then with rotting tomatoes, then with potatoes and apples. One of these latter struck her cheek. She reeled, almost fell, then stood straight again, now raising her swollen but still lovely face so the moon painted it. She looked straight ahead. "Char you tree," they whispered. Roland couldn't hear them, but he could see the words on their lips. Stanley Ruiz was there, and Petty, and Gert Moggins, and Frank Claypool, the deputy with a broken leg. Jamie McCann, who was to have been this year's Reap lad. Roland saw 100 people he had known and mostly liked during his time in Magus. Now these people pelted his love with corn shucks and vegetables as she stood hands bound before her in the back of Rhea's cart. The slowly rolling cart reached Greenheart with its colored paper lanterns and silent carousel where no laughing children rode, no, not this year. The crowd, still speaking those two words, chanting them now, it appeared, parted. Roland saw the heaped pyramid of wood that was the unlit bonfire. Sitting around it, their backs propped on the central column, their lumpy legs outstretched, was a ring of red-handed stuffy guys. There was a single hole in the ring, a single waiting vacancy. And now a woman emerged from the crowd. She wore a rusty black dress and held a pail in one hand. A smear of ash stood out on one of her cheeks like a brand. Roland began to shriek. It was a single word, over and over again. No, 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 no. The ball's pink light flashed brighter with each repetition, as if his horror refreshed and strengthened it. And now, with each of those pulses, Cuthbert and Alan could see the shape of the gunslinger's skull beneath his skin.
"We have to take it away from him," Alan said. "We have to. It's sucking him dry. It's killing him."
Cuthbert nodded and stepped forward. He grabbed the ball, but couldn't take it from Roland's hands. The gunslinger's fingers seemed welded to it.
"Hit him," he told Alan. "Hit him again, you have to."
But Alan might as well have been hitting a post. Roland didn't even rock back on his heels. He continued to cry out that single negative, "No, no, no, no," and the ball flashed faster and faster, eating its way into him through the wound it had opened, sucking up his grief like blood. 25.
"Char you tree!"
Cordelia Delgado cried, darting forward from where she had been waiting. The crowd cheered her, and beyond her left shoulder, Demon Moon winked as if in complicity.
"Char you tree, you faithless bitch! Char you tree!"
She flung the pail of paint at her niece, splattering her pants and dressing her tied hands in a pair of wet scarlet gloves. She grinned up at Susan as the cart rolled past. The smear of ash stood out on her cheek. In the center of her pale forehead, a single vein pulsed like a worm.
"Bitch!"
Cordelia screamed. Her fists were clenched. She danced a kind of hilarious jig, feet jumping, bony knees pumping beneath her skirt.
"Life for the crops, death for the bitch, char you tree, come reap!"
The cart rolled past her. Cordelia faded from Susan's sight, just one more cruel phantasm in a dream that would soon end. "Bird and bear and hare and fish," she thought. "Be safe, Roland. Go with my love. That's my fondest wish."
"Take her," Rhea screamed. "Take this murdering bitch and cook her red-handed. Char you tree!"
"Char you tree," the crowd responded. A forest of willing hands grew in the moonlit air. Somewhere firecrackers rattled, and children laughed excitedly. Susan was lifted from the cart and handed toward the waiting woodpile above the heads of the crowd, passed by uplifted hands like a heroine returned triumphantly home from the wars. Her hands dripped red tears upon their straining, eager faces. The moon overlooked it all, dwarfing the glow of the paper lanterns.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she murmured as she was first lowered and then slammed against the pyramid of dry wood put in the place which had been left for her,
the whole crowd chanting in unison now, "Char you tree! Char you tree! Char you tree!"
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," trying to remember how he had danced with her that night, trying to remember how he had loved with her in the willow grove, trying to remember that first meeting on the dark road.
"Thank ye, Si, we're well met," he had said, and yes, in spite of everything, in spite of this miserable ending, with the folk who had been her neighbors turned into prancing goblins by moonlight, in spite of pain and betrayal and what was coming, he had spoken the truth. They had been well met. They had been very well met indeed.
"Char you tree! Char you tree! Char you tree!"
Women came and piled dry corn shucks around her feet. Several of them slapped her. It didn't matter. Her bruised and puffy face seemed to have gone numb, and one, it was Misha Alvarez, whose daughter Susan had taught to ride, spat into her eyes and then leaped prankishly away, shaking her hands at the sky and laughing. For a moment she saw Coral Thorin festooned with reap charms, her arms filled with dead leaves which he threw at Susan. They fluttered down around her in a crackling, aromatic shower. And now came her aunt again, and Rhea beside her. Each held a torch. They stood before her, and Susan could smell sizzling pitch. Rhea raised her torch to the moon.
"Char you tree!"
she screamed in her rusty old voice, and the crowd responded,
"Char you tree!"
Cordelia raised her own torch.
"Come reap!
Come reap!" they cried back to her.
"Now, you bitch," Rhea crooned. "Now comes warmer kisses than any your love ever gave you."
"Die, you faithless!" Cordelia whispered. "Life for the crops, death for you."
It was she who first flung her torch into the corn shucks which were piled as high as Susan's knees. Rhea flung hers a bare second later. The corn shucks blazed up at once, dazzling Susan with yellow light. She drew in a final breath of cool air, warmed it with her heart, and loosed it in a defiant shout.
"Roland, I love thee!"
The crowd fell back, murmuring, as if uneasy at what they had done now that it was too late to take it back. Here was not a stuffy guy, but a cheerful girl they all knew, one of their own, for some mad reason backed up against the Reetnight bonfire with her hands painted red. They might have saved her, given another moment. Some might have, anyway, but it was too late. The dry wood caught, her pants caught, her shirt caught, her long blonde hair blazed on her head like a crown.
"Roland, I love thee!"
At the end of her life she was aware of heat, but not pain. She had time to consider his eyes, eyes of that blue which is the color of the sky at first light of morning. She had time to think of him on the drop, riding Rusher flat out with his black hair flying back from his temples and his neckerchief rippling. To see him laughing with an ease and freedom he would never find again in the long life which stretched out for him beyond hers. And it was his laughter she took with her as she went out, fleeing the light and heat into the silky, consoling dark, calling to him over and over as she went, calling bird and bear and hare and fish. XXVI. There was no word, not even no, in his screams at the end. He howled like a gutted animal, his hands welded to the ball, which beat like a runaway heart. He watched in it as she burned. Cuthbert tried again to take the cursed thing away and couldn't. He did the only other thing he could think of, drew his revolver, pointed it at the ball, and thumbed back the hammer. He would likely wound Roland, and the flying glass might even blind him, but there was no other choice. If they didn't do something, the glam would kill him. But there was no need. As if seeing Cuthbert's gun and understanding what it meant, the ball went instantly dark and dead in Roland's hands. Roland's stiff body, every line and muscle trembling with horror and outrage, went limp. He dropped like a stone, his fingers at last letting go of the ball. His stomach cushioned it as he struck the ground. It rolled off him and trickled to a stop by one of his limp, outstretched hands. Nothing burned in its darkness now except for one baleful orange spark, the tiny reflection of the rising demon moon. Alain looked at the glass with a species of disgusted, frightened awe. Looked at it as one might look at a vicious animal that now sleeps, but will wake again and bite when it does. He stepped forward, meaning to crush it to powder beneath his boot.
"Don't you dare!"
Cuthbert said in a hoarse voice. He was kneeling beside Roland's limp form, but looking at Alain. The rising moon was in his eyes, two small, bright stones of light.
"Don't you dare! After all the misery and death we've gone through to get it, don't you even think of it!"
Alain looked at him uncertainly for a moment, thinking he should destroy the cursed thing anyway. Misery suffered did not justify misery to come, and as long as the thing on the ground remained whole, misery was all it would bring anyone. It was a misery machine, that was what it was, and it had killed Susan Delgado. He hadn't seen what Roland had seen in the glass, but he had seen his friend's face, and that had been enough. It had killed Susan, and it would kill more if left whole. But then he thought of Kaa and drew back. Later he would bitterly regret doing so.
"Put it in the bag again," Cuthbert said, "and then help me with Roland. We have to get out of here."
The drawstring bag lay crumpled on the ground nearby, fluttering in the wind. Alain picked up the ball, hating the feel of its smooth, curved surface, expecting it to come alive under his touch. It didn't, though. He put it in the bag and looped it over his shoulder again. Then he knelt beside Roland. He didn't know how long they tried unsuccessfully to bring him around, until the moon had risen high enough in the sky to turn silver again, and the smoke roiling out of the canyon had begun to dissipate. That was all he knew. Until Cuthbert told him it was enough. They would have to sling him over Rusher's saddle and ride with him that way. If they could get into the heavily forested lands west of Barony before dawn, Cuthbert said, they would likely be safe. But they had to get at least that far. They had smashed Farson's men apart with stunning ease, but the remains would likely knit together again the following day. Best they be gone before that happened. And that was how they left Eyebolt Canyon and the seacoast side of Mages, riding west beneath the demon moon, with Roland laid across his saddle like a corpse. XXVII. The next day they spent in Ilbosk, the forest west of Magus, waiting for Roland to wake up. When afternoon came and he remained unconscious, Cuthbert said, "See if you can touch him." Alain took Roland's hands in his own, marshaled all his concentration, bent over his friend's pale, slumbering face, and remained that way for almost half an hour. Finally he shook his head, let go of Roland's hands, and stood up.
"Nothing?" Cuthbert asked.
Alain sighed and shook his head. They made a travoy of pine branches so he wouldn't have to spend another night riding over saddle. If nothing else, it seemed to make Rusher nervous to be carrying his master in such a way, and went on, not traveling on the great road, and that would have been far too dangerous, but parallel to it. When Roland remained unconscious the following day, Magus falling behind them now, and both boys feeling a deep tug of homesickness, inexplicable but as real as tides, they sat on either side of him, looking at each other over the slow rise and fall of his chest. "Can an unconscious person starve or die of thirst?" Cuthbert asked. "They can't, can they?" "Yes," Alain said, "I think they can." It had been a long, nerve-wracking night of travel. Neither boy had slept well the previous day, but on this one they slept like the dead, with blankets over their heads to block the sun. They awoke minutes apart, as the sun was going down and Demon Moon, now two nights past the full, was rising through a troubled rack of clouds that presaged the first of the great autumn storms. Roland was sitting up. He had taken the glass from the drawstring bag. He sat with it cradled in his arms, a darkened bit of magic as dead as the glass eyes of the romp. Roland's own eyes, also dead, looked indifferently off into the moonlit corridors of the forest. He would eat, but not sleep. He would drink from the streams they passed, but not speak. And he would not be parted from the piece of Merlin's rainbow which they had brought out of Magus at such great price. It did not glow for him, however. Not, Cuthbert thought once, while Al and I are awake to see it anyway. Alain couldn't get Roland's hands off the ball, and so he laid his own on Roland's cheeks, touching him that way. Except there was nothing to touch. Nothing there. The thing which rode west with them toward Gilead was not Roland, or even a ghost of Roland. Like the moon at the close of its cycle, Roland had gone.